I want to talk with you about the new album, Botanical Gardens, which is absolutely wonderful. And can you tell the story of the inspiration for this album?
Well, for years I've been going to, first of all, I have a lot of garden type properties, you know, that I own that are pretty large, and I spend a lot of time outdoors and just thinking about stuff. But the most interesting time would be walking in the gardens of the Royal Gardens in Sydney, Australia. And it just stuck with me. And for some reason, I do not know how I got to the point of writing this song, but I contrasted writing, walking in those gardens and just kind of thinking about things with the New York City and, you know, the dark, cold, kind of unfriendly city. And so once I had that, I started to work on it. And that's pretty much where the idea came from.
Now, the album was recorded in Nashville, and you did it, if I understand, with your touring band. So that's got to give you a little real level of comfort and knowledge with guys that you take on the road.
Oh, well, these guys have been with me from 10 to 30 years. I've made a lot of albums with Tony Migliori playing the piano or writing the strings or playing electric piano. And, you know, these are long-time relationships that I have with these guys, and I know their families, and we're almost like a family, really. We've had a lot of adventures, that's for sure. And so, you know, they are the best. And my drummer Jerry Croon said, "Why don't you bring us in the studio and let's, you know, play some of these songs?" And so I did some tracks. But then I had them in, and that was a very good idea because we got songs like Ain't She a Honey and Grief and Hope and King of Fools and these kind of things, and it turned out very well.
It sure did. It's such a terrific album, and it showcases a lot of different sides of you. There's certainly some beautiful ballads. I love Till Tomorrow, but some great up-tempo, upbeat songs. Total Eclipse of the Sun is a wonderful song. The title cut, Botanical Gardens. Ain't She a Honey is a throwback to, in many ways, musically, another time and place. But it's a fun album, and I would say it's a very romantic album, too.
Well, I've always been a romantic songwriter. Even a song like Vincent, even a song like American Pie has got a romantic aspect to it. It's always something I've done. Why, I don't know, but I don't write hateful songs or songs that get back at somebody or things like this. And I don't really know why that is, but I love beautiful melodies, and each song I write is different, so I don't really write the same song over and over, although that's a very good talent to have. So I would say that I think that feelings are at the bottom of what I do. Emotion, love, loss, anxiety, you know, whatever, exuberance. They're all, you know, part of what I try to build into a song.
Is that something, especially that romance and frankly, thought and sentiment and emotion and memory seems to be left out of a lot of contemporary music?
Yes, I think we're a bit of a Prozac nation now. We don't really want to feel much. In fact, Jack Nicholson said something in an interview, which I have been talking about. He said, I don't think that audiences in the United States anyway want to be moved anymore. And I think that he's such a brilliant guy, and he says a lot of very interesting things in his interviews, and that was one of them. And I think I have to agree with that. I think people just want to be pounded. you know, with a lot of noise and a lot of wall of sound. They want to dance, and, you know, they want to kind of forget. I think there's a lot of you know, beating until unconscious type of effort behind a lot of entertainment and trying to forget what's going on. I think in some ways maybe the world is too much for people in some ways. We certainly don't have a childhood anymore, because if you have a computer screen in the stomach of a teddy bear, I mean, that's you know, not really a childhood. You're already on the fast track.
It is interesting how the music often reflects the times. And as you were talking about that, I thought of the disco movement of the mid and late 70s that in some ways was a reaction to things that were going on in the country with doubt, with economic troubles. And sometimes the music that becomes popular is an escape from that and doesn't require listeners to think. But I feel like you've always aimed a little higher than that.
Well, really, all of the music in the 1960s and 70s until the mid 70s when the disco thing really hit was, you know, pretty interesting. You know, there were ideas and melodies and thoughts and, you know, songs written about things that were going on. You know, there was a certain level of social consciousness that was built in because the audience was young and they were concerned about the world they were inheriting. And now I just don't think that there is that anymore. And I think there's a form of dance music has really taken over since disco, because rap music is dance music, really. And so it's all a form of sort of party time, you know, and I'm for partying, you know. I think that's a great thing to do. And a lot of these shows that they put on are just party time for kids, and they dig it. You know, they have a great time with everybody getting into it. But they've lost two things. They've lost the ability to write melodies, and they've lost the ability to talk about things in the world in an intellectual way, or even a quasi-intellectual way. I was watching the country music television station just for fun, you know, to see what these videos were like. And every song was built on one note. Everyone. There wasn't really a chord change there. And I switched to Jules Holland, you know, on MTV.
Yeah,
and I watched a lot of more contemporary people, and every song was built, again, on one note. So that's a worry. It really is.
It's interesting you mentioned that about country music. I was actually working in country radio in the 80s when you had a number of hits that crossed over to the country charts, including, I think, the best cover anybody's ever done of Roy Orbison's Crying. But that was also a time, though, when country music, I felt, was more literate, more accepting of outside influences. And now it's sort of the, well, I guess for lack of a better term, the redneckization of country music that's happened in the last few years.
You've got some, back in those days, in the late, early 80s, mid 80s, you had some really good songwriters who were coming up with some damn good songs. And the Crying thing was another, you know, freak accident, which I've had a lot of in my life. Because that, I went to Nashville and recorded with the great, late great, Larry Butler, who made a lot of his records. And so I did an album called Chain Lightning, and I said, I want to sing Crying. And as usual, I got this, what do you want to do that for? I said, well, I just want to. I just had to. And So I said, but I'm going to slow it down, and I'm going to do it like this. And so he loved that. And basically, all of the guys that were on that record were really Elvis's old backup band. The Jordanaires, Bob Moore, Pete Drake, and, you know, the guitarist was Jimmy Capps, Ray Edenson. You know, these guys are legends. And they just turn out hits all day long, you know. So we cut that, and it really made it, and it put strings on it, and it went through the roof.
We're talking with Don McLean here on Downtown. His new album is entitled Botanical Gardens, and one of the songs on there hits close to home for us here in Maine, because it's the true story of a gentleman. If I remember right, is it from Damariscotta, the story of the waving man?
No, he's actually from Camden, Maine.
Oh, okay.
And he was right on the road that went route one?
Yeah, I think it is, yes.
105, that's 105. It goes into Camden from where I live. And he would stay there and wave me out and wave me in. And he did that probably for about 3 years. And as I was working on this album, I said, well, I just have to write a song about the waving man, you know. And so I kind of invented his life, and I sang it around a little bit, and people would come up to me and they'd say, oh, we have a waving man in our town. And so they're all over the place.
I want to talk a little bit about your start in the music business, and did I hear this story correct a while back that seeing the Weavers in a reunion concert was a real inspiration for you to pursue a life in music? Is that right?
Yes, I had been working very hard at my singing and guitar playing and banjo picking from the time I was 15 until I was like 18. And I went, instead of going to the senior prom, I took a young lady to the Weavers reunion at Carnegie Hall. And that was, I think, May sometime of 1963. And once I saw that, I decided I wanted to do that with my life. And but I took with me everything. One of the problems with the folk song revival, as it was called, was that it became very judgmental about all other kinds of music. Now, I got to know a lot of the members of that group, and they were not like that. They were very open-minded to good music. They loved rock and roll, they like Nat King Cole, they like, you know, good music. But a lot of the people that came along, you know, became very discriminating, is a good word for it. And, you know, this song wasn't good enough to be a folk song, and this song isn't a folk song, and all this stuff. And I got really sick of that, you know, and it was basically a cover for being a lousy musician. You know, if anything had more than three chords, their nose would go up, you know. And I was looking to expand and write songs that were complicated and interesting and musical. And so I just couldn't stand the environment after a while, you know. And I kind of had to create my own world.
Well, you certainly did that. And when you mentioned the words interesting and musical and perhaps complicated as well, American Pie certainly fits that. 5 million plays. You were honored from BMI for that accomplishment earlier this year. It's such an epic song. And I guess in the history of pop and rock music, you know, maybe American Pie, perhaps You're So Vain by Carly Simon have to be maybe the two most analyzed songs in history. Did you intend for that to be a bit of a puzzle, a bit of a mystery for listeners?
American Pie was making fun of songs like You're So Vain. That's the thing people don't realize. I was making fun of that Paul is Dead stuff. And, you know, I had a lot of fun with that song. I was doing a lot of different things at once. It's almost very difficult to talk about, and I have done a lot of talking about it in the last 45 years, but I don't think I ever expressed how much fun it was, you know, just to toy with. And once I got the melody and the idea for the way it was going to be structured, and I think that's partly why when the lyrics sold a couple of years ago, people were interested in a lot of the lyrics I didn't use and ideas I had that I didn't put in the song, you know, and things like that.
Well, I've been a fan of your music for a long, long time, from American Pie, obviously. I always think Castles in the Air was my inspiration to get out of a bad relationship along the way. And in recent years, as an older dad, I spent many a night singing my son to sleep with Wonderful Baby.
Well, that's nice to hear. Thank you.
I also love a song of yours that I don't believe was released as a single, but I thought it was a terrific piece of writing, a wonderful story song, Superman's Ghost.
Yeah, it's the story of George Reeves, and I wrote that before this Hollywoodland movie ever got made.
Right.
I was always interested in I'm a repository of useless information about all sorts of things. It's one of my hobbies, I suppose, which is why I love my phone, because I can Google anything, and I spend a lot of time Googling little details of, you know, and looking for things. Totally got me hooked. But, yes, this is about, I guess, about 1983 or 4, I wrote this song, and it was about the interesting pop story of the death of George Reeves and the whole Superman phenomenon on television. And it was a phenomenon. I remember when it first appeared, the kids in the grammar school that I went to were energized about this show. And I read something that was kind of interesting, that George would turn up sometimes with the Superman outfit, but one day some kid brought his father's pistol and wanted to see if those bullets were going to bounce off him. And freaked him out. And he said, "I ain't never wearing that thing again." So he always wore a suit whenever he made any kind of personal appearance.
But also
the whole involvement with his, you know, his women and everything, and Eddie Mannix, you know, that whole story, right. Was a fixer for MGM. It's quite a film noir type of a story, you know, type of thing that James Elway would write about.
But also a nice allegory as well for any artist who gets, well, as George Reeves did, stuck in a Superman role, having to play the songs that people remember from many years ago, and not always wanting to hear new material, and picturing artists as they were. I always think of Rick Nelson's Garden Party as an example too. It's a balancing act to please the fans, but also play the music that satisfies you.
Well, that, you know, that is always going to happen. I mean, if you're lucky enough to have songs that have mass appeal, you know, even a great group like the Rolling Stones have to do Satisfaction. You know, that song stands far and above everything they ever did. And you have to do it. Now you take someone like Frank Sinatra. Now, there was a guy, and Sinatra and Bing Crosby, people like that, had reams of hit records. I mean, because they always sang the song the best, and they got the first shot, or always did the best job on whatever the new song was from one of the great songwriters, whether it was Carolyn Lee or, you know, Jimmy Van Heusen or Irving Berlin or whatever, you know, and they always had the best arrangers and the best everything. And so Sinatra had pages of top 10 records with Tommy Dorsey before he ever embarked on his own career. So, you know, there are these type of superhuman, phenomenal artists. But when you get into the world of the 1950s and 60s, when music goes down to a street level, when everything was, you know, Elvis and head arrangements, you know, in the studio, even though he had Chet Atkins around, you know, he had his boys and he had his Jordanaires and they make the stuff up. And it's the same with the Beatles and the same with me. I mean, I had to make all this up, you know, write it all, record it, knew how it had to sound, okay or say not good to certain kinds of instrumentation, which would put you, you know, in trouble with a producer sometimes who had other ideas. You can't let other people, it's really tough because you can't stifle other people that work with you, and you can't let them walk all over you either. So it's you really don't want to stifle great talent. I have learned to let people, you know, do their thing, and then in a nice way say, well, I'd like to do it a little bit like this, you know, and get around that, because you want people to use their ability. But this is why I was lucky the Beatles had a George Martin, you know, who was there to take up all the slack and fill in all the gaps, you know. So that was a wonderful thing.
Well, Don, you're in great voice on the new album. And I have to think, too, as a songwriter, there's got to be a wonderful feeling to be, I have to think, the only writer who's had his songs covered by both Perry Como and Drake.
Right. Yeah. I definitely have some street creds. There's no doubt about it. And I'm very fortunate. You mentioned Wonderful Baby. I mean, the Fred Astaire version of Wonderful Baby is one of my favorite recordings of one of my songs. So I've been able to have a wonderful sideline, really, of listening to great musical stars do my songs and appreciating, you know, how they, you know, what things they did differently from what I did, you know, and getting some insights into ways of singing even that I might not have had.
Well, there are more Don McLean classics on this new album that is just wonderful. Botanical Gardens is delightful. Get your hands on it. Listen to it. You sound great. The songwriting is fantastic. The production is top-notch. And for anybody who loves Don McLean and wants to discover him anew, listen to this album, and you're going to love it a lot. You've got a big tour coming up. We wish you luck on that.
Thank you. I've got a world tour, actually. It's starting in pieces, and it'll be the UK, England, Ireland, Scotland, and then it'll be Europe in October, and it'll be Australia and the Far East probably next year.
Don, thank you so much. I really appreciate making time for us. I do love the album. I've listened to it about a dozen times in the last several days. It's terrific. Thank you again.
Thanks a lot, Rich. I really appreciate that very, very much.